He most recently was the Deputy Director of Health to Mitch Katz in Los Angeles County. Prior to that, he was the Director of the Southeast Health Center in San Francisco at DPH. Got his MD from UCSF as well. So certainly talked to San Francisco. He's already reached out to CWDA and to myself, given my current ties to San Francisco, to open up dialogue on the human services part of Health and Human Services. So that's encouraging. He begins, I believe, he might begin this Monday, if not next week. Just an update on a couple of our sponsored bills. The first one is Senate Bill 1377. This is Assembly Woman Wicks from the East Bay, Buffy Wicks. This is a bill, again, AB 1377. It's CalFresh for households who are receiving free and reduced lunch. And basically, the bill would hold that households who have school-aged children who are getting free and reduced lunch would be considered categorically eligible for CalFresh, meaning we wouldn't have to do the full-scale eligibility process for those households. That's currently going to be set for hearing April 9th at Assembly Human Services. And then one of the other bills we're supporting is our fairly significant change to the CalWORKs Earned Income Disregard. And this is Assemblyman Mark Stone, Assembly Bill 1436. This is really recognizing a couple things. One is it's trying to account for the increase in the statewide minimum wage, as well as the increase in minimum wage in some cities in California, and adjusting the earned income disregard so that households with a working parent don't become ineligible for aid too soon. And so what it would allow those households to earn more before their grant is reduced and then before they would ultimately be ineligible for aid. So we would allow to be working parents who had a higher minimum wage but still be able to retain the benefits of CalWORKs. In addition, the bill seeks to increase the income threshold for eligible CalWORKs applicants. So currently, the way the law reads, you could have a family in CalWORKs who's earning a certain amount of income who would still be eligible for CalWORKs. You could have a same family earning the same amount of income who's applying for CalWORKs who would be ineligible, and that's how the current law reads. So what we're trying to do is equalize those, recognizing not only the increase in the minimum wage, but I think more importantly, the high cost of living in California, and that the CalWORKs grants and the way that eligibility is determined on the income side isn't keeping pace at all with the high cost of living in California. And so that will be heard in Assembly Human Services in late April, April 23rd. So that's at the state. Let me move to the federal level. A couple items. One is, this just happened either earlier this week or last week, where a letter from the Trump administration, a letter from the Department of Justice to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, basically saying that the entirety of the Affordable Care Act should be struck down in the courts, which, rather than just some elements of the act that had been the prior position of the Trump administration, where candidate Trump and then President Trump had expressed support for protecting people with pre-existing conditions. He seems to have now flipped on that, and at least through his Department of Justice, who's now saying that the entirety of the act should be struck down. Of course, that would take an act of Congress, given the control, unless the court were to act, and then all the way up to the Supreme Court, and who knows how that would play out. At the same time, the Democrats have a new health care proposal to refine the Affordable Care Act a bit, to do, among other things, reduce the health care premiums, which would to cap out-of-pocket costs at 10%, 10% of income, excuse me. Expanding tax credits for those beyond 400% of federal poverty level, so allowing tax credits for higher income households. And then reinstating the guarantee for those with pre-existing conditions, disallowing non-ACA compliant plans. Remember, the Affordable Care Act sets certain standards that health plans must meet. That's been undercut by the administration. So that's out there as well. And it seems like, you know, the Affordable Care Act, again, is back in play, at least from the White House. And again, given the makeup of the House, it's not likely to move anywhere. But it, again, is an indication of where the administration is at. I should also say that the administration had allowed, at state option, work requirements for Medicaid. And I think 11 states began the process of instituting work requirements as part of the eligibility to receive health insurance through Medicaid. The courts yesterday in a ruling found that that is not legal. And for example, Arkansas saw more than 18,000 households cut off from Medicaid due to non-compliance with work requirements. So the court has reversed that, which is good news. It certainly wouldn't affect California. California would never go that direction in terms of work requirements, but it does sort of uphold the tenet of the Affordable Care Act that everyone should be entitled to health care, irrespective of whether they participate in work activities. The other item at the federal level is the Trump administration sent its proposed FY 2020 budget to Congress, and in it included massive cuts to Health and Human Services programs, pretty much the same programs, the same proposals that were in last year's proposed budget, all of which were rejected last year. And so this budget is largely dead on arrival in Congress. The House is unlikely even to hold hearings on the proposals. Examples of the cuts, some of the cuts, Medicaid being slashed by $1.5 trillion over 10 years, removing the entitlement status for foster care funding and turning it into a block grant, reducing TANF, which is the CalWORKs funding, by 9%. I could go on and on. It's kind of more of a waste of my breath since it's not going anywhere, but again, an indication from the White House of where their position is on most of the programs that we administer locally. Moving to the local level, there's a hearing scheduled for the Board of Supervisors on April 4th that directly relates to us. Let me give you sort of what the hearing's about and how we got there. The hearing was called by Supervisor Peskin, and the hearing is to review the process by which departments seek approval by the Board of Supervisors for contracts that exceed $10 million. So per the admin code, when we have contracts that you approve as a commission over $10 million, we then have to seek Board of Supervisors approval to execute that contract. There was a contract with the Tenderloin Housing Clinic that used to be under the Human Services Agency, was then transitioned over to the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing. In that transition, what got lost was the need to seek approval for an amendment to that contract that occurred under our agency, but then was transitioned. And so the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing caught it, but then had to get retroactive approval from the board for a contract that was about $118 million. So justifiably so, Supervisor Peskin was fairly annoyed, annoyed enough to call a hearing overnight to review all of the contracts at the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing and the Human Services Agency to ensure that we're in compliance with the admin code of getting approval for all of our contracts that are over $10 million. So we sent Circle back to look at all the contracts we had that are over $10 million and all of them that had been approved by the commission over the last 10 years. We had 43 such contracts. All of them, except for the Tenderloin Housing Clinic contract, were approved by this commission and went to the board for their approval. There was one additional contract approved by the Commission on Aging and Adult Services with Meals on Wheels exceeding $10 million that did not go to the board either. That will be going to the board next week for their retroactive approval. So the hearing really is about, there's a couple purposes. One is for Supervisor Peskin to show the newer board members that the board does have a role in some contracting approval in the city. And the second is really to slap the department's hands and say, don't do this again. So we have since put in a few controls to make sure it won't happen again. These include requiring our director of contracts to approve any contract, grant, or modification. So all of them will go across the contract director's desk. We're going to ensure concurrent approval processes at the boards and the commissions. So what will happen is when a contract exceeding $10 million goes to each of the commissions, it would also go to the board at the same time, because there could be delays, and we don't even want a non-retroactive approval. We don't want to even see retroactive approval for a month at this point. And then in our automated workflow system that goes through our contracts division, there will be a notation that when contracts need board approval. So this was really a one-off, largely due to the transition to the new department. The Meals on Wheels one, we're sort of trying to figure out how that happened, but I think it'll be, in the end here, it'll be fine. It might get a little bit of press, depending on how much Supervisor Peskin wants to make hay of it. On the Communications Division, I will be hosting the third annual series of town halls for staff beginning April 9th. There will be two sessions open to all staff, and all sessions, of course, are open to commissioners as well. Tuesday, April 9th, and Tuesday, April 30th, and will be the ones that are open to all staff held here at Warren Auditorium. And then additional sessions will be held at the service centers at 1235 Mission, 1440 Harrison, and then 3125 Mission Street. We'll be getting notices out for that if you guys want to attend. Basically, it allows me to engage staff in our priorities and plans for the upcoming year, talk about what's going on at the federal and state levels, local levels. We do a Q&A. It's just a way to sort of, you know, another mode of communicating with staff on what we're doing here. Last year, when I did it, we had about 600 employees collectively attend, which is about 25% of all of HSA, which is not bad. So hopefully, through other communication channels, we'll get more attendance this year. Also, in communications, as the tax season is coming to a close, just want to bring to your attention what we did through our communications divisions around getting the word out on the Working Families Tax Credit and the free tax prep services that go on throughout the city. So we launched an outreach campaign to talk about the 30 different locations in the city that provides free tax prep. This is in partnership with the United Way. We also promoted the San Francisco Working Families Credit, which is now up to $500, which is double what it was last year. We had a new webpage called freetaxhelpsf.org, which was embedded in our site. Direct mail notices went to all of our households on Medi-Cal, CalFresh, and CalWorks, Muni ads in various languages, and then a social media campaign through various social media channels, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. So once the tax season is complete, we have all the filing data. We'll look and see if there's an uptick in utilization of the free tax prep, and of course of the application for the Working Families Credit, the Earned Income Tax Credit at the federal level, the Earned Income Tax Credit at the state level, and child care tax credits that our households are eligible for. Within our divisions, you're gearing up for the end of the SSI exclusion of CalFresh, the end of what's called the cash out. Our outreach team is working closely with the Department of Aging and Adult Services and other community partners on scheduling outreach for CalFresh and CalFresh in a day, targeting seniors and individuals on SSI. Again, the end of the SSI cash out, or the beginning of eligibility for SSI recipients for CalFresh, begins in June. And then last week we had our annual federal USDA audit. It's basically a management review that focuses on CalFresh and employment training, our tracking for ABODs, and then our processes for electronic benefits transfer, EBT card issuance. State CDSS officials were also there, so that the process for management review, they interview staff at our benefit centers for the employment training program, interviewed workforce development staff, did case reviews, and did fiscal reviews as well. The management review seemed to go fine. We're awaiting a report, but we're not expecting anything, any findings of any significance. In our county dual assistance programs, we launched our new intake portal. I think I talked about it last month, on February 11th. We have so far had 75 referrals. We're currently working on our internet page to better advertise this portal. That should be updated by May. We want to target clients, of course, but we also want to target CBOs who are working with clients so they can be aware of the online portal, begin the application process for clients. The web page will explain sort of how to apply, what documentation you need. We're hoping that we'll have to do sort of minimal outreach once this is up and running, and really have folks, once they come in, have all the documents, not have to come in again and get on quickly and as easily as they can, provided that they're eligible. Getting on county dual assistance program is becoming, I think, more and more important for our low-income single adults, especially as the grant increases. And starting April 1st, the grant will increase again, increase by 10%, because it mirrors the CalWORKs grant increases. So for SF residents who are here more than 30 days, or on one of our CAP programs, and being housed, so they're not in care, not cash, we'll see their monthly grant go from $473 to $520 a month. And then again on October 1st, we'll see another increase as the CalWORKs grant increases, provided that the governor's proposal goes through in June. And then lastly, in our child welfare division, just a quick update on our CCR implementation, our continuum of care reform. And just as a reminder for those who are here and also for you, the CCR is the very large child welfare reform, one of the tenets being moving kids away from congregate care, group homes, and into shorter stays in therapeutic environments and placements with families. And so we have been moving internally work with our community partners on getting kids out of our group homes and transition into the what are called STRTPs, which are the short-term therapeutic environments. We're seeing a significant decline just over sort of a year to year from March 18 to March 2019. We've seen our group home population decline by almost 70%, by 69%. We've also seen our STRTP population actually decline, which is good. It means that kids are receiving the shorter term treatment and hopefully moving into families or even being reunified in some cases. We've seen that drop by 35%. So in total, we've seen a 53% drop of kids in the congregate type placements, which is exactly what we want to see with CCR. And then secondly, in child welfare, just our, I want to let you know, we have our annual foster parent appreciation event. They're now called Resource Families. It's scheduled for Friday, May 10th, 6 p.m. It's going to be in the South San Francisco Conference Center, which is where we hold most of our events for our resource families. Invitations to the commissioners will be coming very soon, so look for those. We'd love to see you there. It's always a great event to celebrate our resource families, and especially as we need to recruit more and more and retain more and more because of the pressures from CCR. So hope to see you all there. I'll conclude with that. Open to questions.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Monthly, thank you. I have 3 points on my paper here. Maybe that's to be expected, 3 points. First, to a connector. I'm struck by the juxtaposition between the lack of attention to the human services that we hear in response to the president's budget. We hear about education, but you don't hear about the cuts you hear. And then locally, the juxtaposition is we get the attention from the Board of Supervisors and Supervisor Peskin. And is there in your mind some policy issues going on that local is a response to what's going on national?
Yeah, that's a good question, Commissioner. I think the attention that Supervisor Peskin is paying to this issue is more procedural. You know, he tends to be in the weeds on board procedure and is known as probably the sharpest board member on board procedure. And I think that when departments and the executive branch of the city government run afoul of those, he tends to point that out and garner attention to exert the power of reminding folks that the Board of Supervisors indeed does have power and authority almost equal to the executive branch of city government. I don't think it has to do with what the feds are doing around our issues. Unfortunately, an example, the TANF program, which of course authorizes the local CalWORKs program, hasn't seen a reauthorization in 8 years, maybe more. It just keeps going on a continuing resolution. It just never seems to get the attention of lawmakers in DC. There was a proposal last year to reauthorize TANF that actually has some positive changes, even from it came from House Ways and Means, which was then controlled by Republicans. But that didn't even move. And so, you know, the issues programs that we administer, the related issues, you know, obviously Medicaid, Medi-Cal gets a lot of attention through the Affordable Care Act, but the other programs don't get a whole lot. The reauthorization of the Farm Bill got a little bit. We talked about more stringent work requirements for SNAP, food stamps, and some more restrictions, but at the end, we ended up okay on that as well. So, you know, in terms of the board's response, I think it's, in this case, procedural one.
Third point on my notes, therapeutic environments.
Yes.
You spoke about the reductions at the group level, how we're doing in creating those therapeutic environments, and how is the community responding to that? And how is it making the community stronger to have these environments out there?
So what we've attempted to do in this past many years ago is look at our current portfolio of group homes and group home providers, and work with them to walk through the new requirements to become an STRTP, short-term therapeutic intervention. The state Department of Healthcare Services and the Department of Social Services has to approve those plans that are submitted by our providers. Of course, we're working with them to try to get them sort of at a level where they would be approved. Some of our providers, more sophisticated providers, were able to do that. And what it means is adding staff, adding a new type of staff, higher trained, more clinically trained staff. The rate they receive from the state, from us, is higher, so it can support a more intensive environment. Most of them have come along. There have been some that haven't. And I think that for our kids, our community of kids that we work with, given the numbers, I think that the outcomes are at least initially trending better. You know, in the reason CCR went forward was that too often kids who needed more supervision, maybe due to the behavioral problems or mental health issues or whatever the trauma that they faced from their abuse, and would be placed in group homes, which is the more higher level of supervision, but then they'd be there for long periods of time. And someone once said, and I don't remember who it was, but I liked the quote, that growing up in an institution only prepares a youth for another institution at adulthood. And generally that institution wouldn't be a good one. And so the idea of, look, let's not park kids in group homes for years, let's instead put kids in a very short term, it's limited to 6 months, environment that is very intensely therapeutic is good for the kid, and that's based on best practices throughout the country. So the movement is a good one. I think for those group homes and group home providers that didn't make the cut, you may have seen there's an article in the San Jose Mercury News last week, I believe, on Unity Care, which is a provider that has a home in South San Francisco as well as many in San Jose, had their license revoked, their STRTP license revoked. Kids were moved out because they didn't meet the standards of the STRTP. And so the increased oversight by the state, the increased requirements on this, all for the better purposes and better services for kids, is a good one. But you have seen some group home providers go under.
Without laboring it, it just seems that if we're going to get more and more attention on the fiscal side, then the programs that we're deeply invested into, in terms of impacting the community, are the ones we have to put forward and really take care of.
I think so, and it also requires us to set up a a set of intensive services post SDRTP placement, right? So if we want to move a child out of that more institutional setting into a family-based setting, those therapeutic supports have to be there for that family, for the child in that family environment. We can't ask a resource parents, resource family, foster parents, to have a child with intense needs without the training or without the mental support going on. And so we're building up that infrastructure as well through wraparound services, through partnerships with Seneca and Edgewood and others to be able to support those placements and move kids out of institutions quicker. Thank you.
Presentation of the March 2019 Employee of the Month Award, Annie Chan Mack. I've got a long
you may want
to see on you, so you may stand and face the people as I speak. Right? And say, don't be on the stand, come to the bank. The commission is pleased to honor Annie Chan Mack as the March 2019 Employee of the Month. Annie is a business analyst with the IT department and part of the Cal Win team. Annie grew up in the Medicare Cal program and joined the IT Cal Win team 5 years ago as a senior business analyst. Her deep knowledge of program processes and culture, coupled with her aptitude for learning technical skills, made her the perfect business analyst. She analyzes and troubleshoots systems, issues, from the customer's perspectives and offer solutions that make sense to them. She introduces technical solutions to simplify and streamline processes while recognizing that technology is not necessarily always the answer. For an example, before there was an iTask, Annie designed, implemented, and manage a task management and worker notification system for the Medi-Cal program, which became one of the foundations for the current system. Some of Annie's outstanding traits are her curiosity and her tenacity in learning new skills and concepts. She applies herself 110% to acquiring a skill or solving a problem, oftentimes staying at work long after everyone else has gone home. As an example of this, she learned and honed her knowledge of Excel, AdSense, Crystal Reporting, and SQL to give her the basic tools needed to collect, query, and present data. Annie recognized early on the importance of data to inform decision making, and as such, has proven invaluable in helping management make insightful decisions. Annie loves data. Spreadsheets. Pivot table. She would gladly wallow in them all day. Whether it is putting together multi-year budget projections or making operational decisions, one can lean on Annie to provide data that is accurate and meaningful. In the 5 years she has been with the Cal Win team, Annie has sought to learn every nook and cranny of this very complex computer system. This makes her the go-to expert to her colleagues within IT, customers within the agency, community-based organizations, and county and state partners. If she does not have the information needed, she will give her best effort to find it. There are many times when Annie had to quickly step into the role of leading the team in addition to doing her regular duties, delivering with her trademark efficiency and always exuding an air of calm, and even in the midst of chaos. She is an ultimate team member, treating everyone with fairness and always seeking the best in each individual. Annie is very generous, not only in sharing her skills, knowledge, and time, but also in keeping a glass jar always filled with candy. To which her co-workers do a daily pilgrimage to satisfy mid-afternoon sugar cravings. Sugar. Annie's strong work ethic, adherence to high standard of work, willingness to learn, reliability, and generosity make her an invaluable team member and is truly deserving of recognition. On behalf of the commissioners, myself, we thank you, Annie. Mr. Rohr, would you like to add a word?
No way I can talk about that. Thank you, Commissioner McCray. Well done. I just want to bring it back to what we do as an agency, and which is providing the best customer service, access to benefits that households are entitled to the best way we can. And we can't do that without technology, without technology supports, without looking at data and knowing where we need to improve, and you know, which is why we're already especially using Affordable Care Act and CalHERS and CalWIN as an example, and how difficult it was to launch the Affordable Care Act being hamstrung by technology. It's really important to have someone who knows the business processes of Medi-Cal, but also technology and ability to use data. So, I love when we get to honor folks who don't work directly with clients on the front line, because everything in every position we have in the agency goes towards that, providing great customer service and making sure we do right by our clients. So you're being honored for that, as well as for your work in your candy jar. So.
Staff, you know, because without the direction, all of us cannot move on. Currently, you know, we take for my supervisor, my coworker, and especially our IT director, because she really has a sense of humor. So make my job relax a little bit, because I sit very close to the director's room. but I'm so glad, you know, I realized it. Start from the mashed potato, and now I felt like get all this support, and I'm learning from day to day from all of you. And I can change the potato to a little more bigger and a little more variety to serve my customers. Not only mashed potato steamed, now we have a little more variety, which is cashew. What else?
French fries.
French fries. Different flavor. And even more. So really, thank you everyone for your support. Last, for the candy jar, be very honest with you, the candy jar is mine, but the candy itself is not, I'm not the only contributor. Actually, this app is from my boss. And she actually, I think sometimes it's not that no sweet, it's actually, it's the thought, and this is heavy. And she carried it all the way from Berkeley this morning. So I don't think I need anything special. The reason why I could carry the bag is because I fly. And also, not only learned that, actually, Natalie is a contributor for candies as well. So I just want to make sure, you know, you guys know, the drug is belongs to me, but the candy is not. So, again, thank you for all of you coming and the recognition. Really means a lot to me.
To the San Francisco community for the 494 verified child victims in
in 2018 is $223.6 million. Abused children are more likely to experience negative educational, health, and behavioral outcomes, which contribute to many of San Francisco's challenges, such as homelessness, chronic health issues, and high school dropout rates. And whereas while child abuse crosses all zip codes, socioeconomic levels, ethnicities, and family structures, it is important to recognize that the rates of child maltreatment are not equally distributed along racial and ethnic lines. Rates of substantiation are significantly higher among Black, Native American, and Latin families than any other ethnic group. This is a result of a complex constellation of factors that is just beginning to be understood. And
whereas the majority of child abuse cases stem from situations that are preventable, and child abuse can be reduced by making sure every family has the support it needs to enhance their five protective factors of children's social emotional competence, parents' knowledge of parenting and child development, parents' resilience, family's social connections, and family's concrete supports. And whereas effective prevention efforts succeed because of meaningful collaboration and partnerships among public and private organizations and the community, San Francisco has created an important network of programs and policies that prevent child abuse and improve the response when abuse does happen, and continues to ensure greater collaboration in the community. And whereas it is essential to continue to raise awareness about child abuse and its devastating impact, and support all vulnerable children and their families.
Now, therefore, we, the Human Services Commission, join with others, including Human Services Agencies and Safe and Sound, to recognize April 2019 as Child Abuse Prevention Month. We urge our community to join together to shine a light on child abuse and stand up for vulnerable children. For our city's future, we all have the responsibility to unite to support each family's efforts to keep themselves and their children safe and healthy, and acknowledge the accomplishments of families, public and private organizations, and communities working together to end child abuse.
Thank you.
What is a vulnerable child?
Well, anybody who could be at risk of being abused or neglected, particularly young, you know, like 0 to 5, I mean, 11, 12, they're still vulnerable, but they can only speak for themselves.
Yeah. That's whereas, to support all vulnerable children, how do we get our minds around that in San Francisco? Is it collaborating with school districts? Is it, how are we saying who that is? Or is that just?
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think when we're talking about vulnerable kids, we're looking at those kids that have higher risk factors, as well as those that live in communities with higher risk factors. We're looking at both individual risk factors, familial risk factors, and community risk factors. And that collaboration is key. So, that's a, we're the Child Abuse Council for Child Abuse Prevention Council for San Francisco, and the collaboration that we have with Family and Children's Services, the Department of Human Services Agency, has been essential, and we also partner with many other agencies in the city. And very exciting, we just created a collaboration to do a countywide prevention program, which we just kicked off at the end of January. And that includes the school district, this department, DCYF, public health, many other community agencies as well.
My thinking and training is, who's the one? And have we gone and got them? Have we done something with the one?
The one child?
The one.
The one who we say is vulnerable, so that everyone else around us in the system knows. HSA says, this is a vulnerable child, this is what it's doing with them, this is what all of us are trying to do. The one.
Well, yes. I mean, the answer to your question is yes. And as Jenny mentioned, at the end of January, we, you know, a prevention committee kicked off, and we're actively working on like some asset, you know, mapping about where some of our most vulnerable communities are, although we have a pretty good idea what's available in those communities and how we can work on prevention, because really the key to all of this is prevention. We'd like to prevent things. We'd like to prevent child abuse before we got involved, but when we get involved, we do our very best to make sure the kids and the families have services to address the issues that brought them to us, whether it's, you know, homelessness, drug addiction, substance abuse, domestic violence, things like that.
Are the children who are working through our therapeutic environments, what are they? Are they some of them, part of them, none of them in this vulnerable child?
There's some of them. So, there are some.
So we know those, and we're working with those we know.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. I think what Commissioner McRae raised the issue, because when we do this every month, we call attention to some issue or other. Before this often occurs, and it's, what's the follow-up? What do we do more than this issue of proclamation? And I think it's very important for us to find ways to publicize what we're doing and how we're doing it, and making sure that the public knows that A, this is an issue, and B, something needs to be done about it, and C, this agency is doing it, but it's everybody's responsibility.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
We don't this year.
We don't.
And not this year. Absolutely. And I have, speaking on behalf of a community-based agency, I think Family and Children's Services has really come a long way in trying to ensure that the public knows that they're not only trying to support kids that come into the system, but they're also trying to prevent child abuse before. As Mr. Rohr pointed out, we usually have an event at City Hall. We're not able to do that this year for Child Abuse Prevention Month, but we will be having all kinds of social media and
virtual flag
communication, yes, virtual flag raising to raise awareness about Child Abuse Prevention Month.
Is there a motion?
However, I will pull Peskin and amend the proposed text to indicate signature by Dr. McRae and today's date,
okay.
March 28th.
Yep. Thank you, Commissioner. Duly noted.
A second. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Now, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, item B. It's Doris Barone.
Barone.
Good morning, Commission.
Good morning.
My name is Doris Barone. I'm the Disaster Preparedness Manager for Human Services Agency, requesting authorization to modify the existing grant agreement with the American Red Cross Bay Area Chapter to provide fiscal intermediary services for the Emergency Hotel Extension Program during the period July 1, 2018 to June 30, 2021, for an additional amount of $114,000 plus a 10% contingency for a revised total amount not to exceed $323,400. The grantee will provide direct response services related to the Emergency Hotel Extension Program on behalf of the agency to assist displaced residents who are affected by disasters such as fires or unaffordable housing conditions and other emergency situations with temporary housing needs. The purpose of the modification is to increase the funding for the 3 fiscal years of the contract term due to increased response efforts. The full funding goes directly towards the emergency temporary housing efforts, and the American Red Cross Bay Area Chapter does not charge any fee toward this effort. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
So would you explain to me really quickly how it works? What, I have a disaster, emergency, and I do what?
Sure, so there are people in San Francisco that are potentially displaced by a fire. That's the most common situation. If folks are eligible for the program, meaning that they make 100% AMI, or below that, they are eligible to receive temporary short-term housing through the American Red Cross. They are granted a debit card where it is filled with some money that allows them a temporary stay in a hotel while they determine where they're going to live for a longer period of time.
What's the maximum amount of time? Like, say, 3 nights, 3, 5 nights?
I believe it's 3 nights, yeah.
It's three, but very often it gets extended through our own money or through a partnership with Red Cross.
But then how many applicants did we receive last year?
Last year, I don't have that number in front of me, I apologize.
But I just heard you say it's because of increase.
Yes, so we had a situation in December in particular that displaced 19 individuals. Because of the time of year and our inability to place them quickly, they had a much longer hotel stay than usual. So the forecast was off a bit because our numbers were increased in December.
I'm glad to see this collaboration between the agency and the Red Cross, because it's working with an agency that knows what to do. We've been doing it for years and years. And in this city where housing is such an issue, to work with an agency that knows what they're doing really, really makes sense.
Thank you.
Move approval.
Second.
All those in favor? All those in favor say aye. Thank you, Mr. Rowan.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Iwasaki.
Good morning, Commissioners. The Department of Human Services requests authorization to enter into a contract with parents and teachers for the period of February 1, 2019 to June 30, 2022 in a total amount of not to exceed $50,000. The purpose of the contract is to provide parent and teachers foundation and model implementation trainings for the staff of the Families Rising Program, formerly known as Project 500. Parents as Teachers is an evidence-based curriculum for providing home visiting services to parents with very young children. In 2019, the state of California began funding the CalWORKs Home Visiting Initiative, which requires county human services agencies to partner with public agencies and community providers to offer evidence-based home visiting programs on a voluntary basis to first-time parents or caretaker parents, caretaker relatives participating in CalWORKs who are pregnant or parenting a child under 2 years of age. In order to meet the CalWORKs Home Visiting Initiative requirements, San Francisco County expanded its Families Rising program to incorporate the PAT, Parents as Teachers, evidence-based model. Services include performing home visits to conduct family-centered assessments and group facilitation to increase parent knowledge and confidence, with the goal of providing early detection of developmental delays and health issues, preventing child abuse and neglect, and increasing school readiness. Families Rising will also continue to provide support to families by coordinating with partner agencies and community-based organizations to help move families to self-sufficiency. The trainings provided by PAT will offer certification so that staff are able to implement the program and provide services with fidelity to the model. Under this contract, PAT will deliver the approved training curriculum on-site in San Francisco to as many as 14 Families Rising mentors and supervisors. They are based in Missouri, so I'm here to answer any questions, and Terry Austin, Families Rising Program Manager, is here as well.
I'm going to explain my ignorance, but it strikes me as a very small amount to do a lot of work.
This is the training for the staff. The staff will be doing it. It's training for this evidence-based curriculum that's required by the state.
Because it's such an important thing.
Yes.
$50,000 or $50,000.
Will the training be done? And then, is it a train the trainer model as well?
No.
It's not, it's just a one-off. So the actual work of the home visiting isn't done under this contract. This is just training to the model to allow practitioners to maintain fidelity to the model and make sure that the services they're providing are the right set of services.
Ms. Iwasaki. Now, the group, you said your last paragraph ended with, they're not from here, they're from where?
PAT is based in Missouri. We're using their approved evidence-based curriculum.
What happens to it once we use it and we have it?
Right.
I mean, who, what then?
According to Terry Austin and the Rising Manager, what happens is once the, what we call mentors, they're social workers, they are able to go into homes and do the home visiting using the curriculum. Mm-hmm. Using the curriculum, they are able to build skills between the parent and child. It's about parent attachment, mm-hmm. so that the family can more easily move forward and seek employment and children will be community.
Yeah, thank you. But I'm going to know what happens in terms of our relationship with you using your product going forward.
Oh, I am a county employee. Our relationship with PAT continues. We become an affiliate of the model, and we continue to use the model and build staff skills to continue to be able to work with families.
I mean, I just want to know, we get to use it, we get to train people, we get to build people up to continually use it. And as an affiliated with them.
Yes.
That's what I was looking for. Okay. Because sometimes it's just you can use it one time and then you can't use it anymore. So I didn't know.
Yeah, this contract is ongoing so that we can continue to receive further training from PAT and continue to build the skills and be able to broaden our families that we can serve.
Thank you.
Before I second that motion, I have just a technical question, and I apologize in advance because this has been explained before, but I mean, in the past at our meetings. But since this is a nonprofit, how come this is a contract and not a grant?
That's it. Good morning, Commissioners. John Sitacala, Director of Contracts. And so the city has two kinds of contracts, grants and contracts. And so grants is really a type of contract that meets certain conditions. And so this was laid out by the city attorney's office probably about 15 years ago. So the four conditions, if I can remember them all, to be a grant, it has to be a nonprofit. It has to have been procured through some type of process. In this case, it's a state process. It can't be work that was done by a civil service employee before, so we can't contract out civil service work. The fourth one is that it can't be to the benefit of the city or to city staff. And so the area that sometimes we have nonprofits that are training, and we interpret training city staff as the benefit to the city staff, and that's why some of these fall into the contract rather than the grant, but that's the only reason. Otherwise, it would be a grant.
Good. Thank you.
Thanks, John. I second the motion.
All right. It's moved and seconded. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Stay right there.
So the Department of Human Services requests authorization to enter into a new contract agreement with UC Davis for the period of July 1, 2019 to June 30, 2022 in an amount of $522,750 plus a 10% contingency for a total amount not to exceed $575,025. The purpose of the contract is for the provision of social work and related skills training to staff from across several departments within the city and county of San Francisco and for provision of the voter fraud detection and prevention training for San Francisco agency staff. The social work and related skills trainings will be provided to Calvert staff and staff from across several departments within the city and county of San Francisco and CBOs who are implementing Families Rising. Families Rising is a collaboration among the city's main agencies serving low-income families, HSA, Department of Public Health, child support services focusing on providing intensive resources, wraparound services, and case management for the city's most at-risk families. UC Davis's trainings focus on social work intervention skills and tools, theoretical knowledge, and best practices for working with families living in scarcity. During the contract term, UC Davis will provide annually a minimum of 30 full-day trainings on-site in San Francisco, with each training session holding up to 35 participants. For the welfare fraud training, CDSS, California Department of Social Services, mandates that employees receive an annual training in welfare fraud prevention and detection. UC Davis's CDSS-approved training curriculum presents techniques that can help workers prevent fraud by educating clients, conducting thorough interviews, completing legal forms, and following standard procedures. Participants gain a greater understanding of the federal and state requirements that govern the CalWORKs, CalFresh, and Medi-Cal programs to assist them in their role of ensuring correct and accurate benefits are issued to applicants and recipients of aid. During the contract term, UC Davis will provide trainings either via online modules or instructor-led for 800 staff, including HSA eligibility workers, non-eligibility staff, and investigators. So I'm available to answer the questions. Terry Austin, Families Rising Program Manager, and Katrina Williams, HSA Learning and Organizational Development Manager, and representatives from UC Davis are here as well.
How has it gone in terms of your evaluation and determination to go forward with a new contract?
As far as the Families Rising training, we have been very pleased with how it's been going. UC Davis brings skills and abilities and knowledge in specialized fields for the social workers, and we've had monthly trainings for them, and the staff are very pleased with what they're learning from UC Davis, and we have been wanting to continue with this ongoing for both Families Rising and the CalWORKs program as well.
All right, you want to make a motion? I don't know if you
said. Do
you want to help? Okay. There's a motion to accept.
Second.
All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Number three, E.
The Department of Human Services requests authorization to modify the existing grant with Housing Families for the provision of Housing Locator, Housing Connector, and Housing Stabilization Services to CalWORKs participants for the period of March 1st, 2019 to June 30, 2019, in an additional amount of $174,211. Plus a 10% contingency for a revised total grant amount not to exceed $8,184,805. The purpose of this modification is to provide additional services during the current 2018-19 fiscal year. A homelessness has been identified as one of the major barriers that impact the CalWORKs family's ability to participate in required activities and meet program requirements that lead to self-sufficiency. Senate Bill 855 allocated state funding for housing supports to since the inception of the CalWORKs Child Support Program in 2014, 364 CalWORKs families have been placed in permanent housing. The grantees continue to provide CalWORKs families living in shelters, transitional housing programs, and families who are at risk of losing their permanent housing with housing locator services, which includes identifying the unit and providing unit descriptions for housing places in the placement process. Housing connector services, which includes working with the locators, the CalWORKs social worker, and the CalWORKs families to match and place the families with available housing units and assist families throughout the lease application and placement process. And then housing stabilization services for out-of-county housing placements, which includes intensive case management through regular meetings with participants to track movement assistance, rental subsidies for up to a year at household goods. So this modification will provide for additional staffing capacity and pass-through funding to support the placement of 25 additional families and the housing stabilization for an additional 10 families this fiscal year. I'm available to answer any questions, and Tim Evans and Sarah Scott from Hamilton Valleys is here as well.
Let's see, you know, if you got some housing, I want to see you.
Good morning. Jim McGinnis, I am the Director of Housing and Family Services for all Hamilton families.
Good to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thank you so much for having me. And this is Sonia Scott. She is my assistant director of our CalWORKS program, as well as some of our subsidy programs. And she has been with the agency for about 4 months now.
How are we doing with what I call working through the regulations, the rules, to try to find a way to get people who are at this level to make this level?
Yeah.
How are you doing?
We have found that we are trying to have families thrive while they're in our transitional housing, our shelter programs, as well as families that are coming from the streets through CalWORKS to receive integrated services. And so we're finding that we are having to expand through several different counties throughout the Bay Area, because affordable housing is not in San Francisco and or Oakland at this point. And most of our subsidy programs will not allow for the AMR, FMR, because of the family's incomes. And so there's a huge disparity, as well as inequity, with the families that we are getting into our programs. And so we're trying to have a growth mindset and allowing our families to be placed in different counties, but looking at, are there integrated services that provide them mental health, HIV, substance abuse, trauma, domestic violence services, and we're having now to relocate and connect communities that may be rural, that may be Modesto, Fresno, Sacramento, because their rents are a lot cheaper. Yes. And so our case managers are going out there and meeting with these families via one-on-ones, Zoom, Skype, trying to at least connect them to some form of technology and refer them to those services within those integrated communities where people may not look like them, but that's the best suitable community for them, because they can thrive with their children and have access to now support services, as well as adequate education for their kids.
So my question is to all of us, but I guess to Mr. Roy. Who's helping us, county, you know, five counties, all the way to Stanislaus, to try to look at what kind of new policies are we going to need to deal with this? Because for us, on our side of it, land is becoming more and more expensive. You can't build cheaply on it. Somebody needs to look at it.
We have. And let me first start saying, you know, despite all of these challenges in the high housing market, the program since its inception has housed 364 families, which is remarkable, really. I think up to 90% are out of county, which presents another challenge. I think that the biggest challenge with this for us is that the CalWORKS program, there are 58 counties in California, and each county has its own CalWORKS program. This funding goes to the CalWORKS program. Right. But the rules say that once a family moves out of the county, let's say we place them in Alameda County, that family then moves to Alameda County's CalWORKS program. So they essentially lose sort of the continuum of services that we're providing in our program, because every county program is a little bit different. You know, same rules, but different sort of sets of services and the way to deliver services. So that's really the biggest challenge, is sort of, you know, we have a regional housing market, clearly. We have a regional economy, a regional transportation system, yet because of this program and the way that it's administered at the state, it's 58 separate programs, if you will. So we've been working with. Go ahead.
I was going to say, we've been working with our Bay Area colleagues, Alameda County Director, Contra Costa, mostly. We've had several regional meetings to sort of figure out how we might change the regulations, how we might change the rules around this program to make it more perhaps a regional housing subsidy program rather than a county by county housing program, because it just doesn't really make sense given the nature of sort of the expense of housing here, and even in Alameda it's becoming more and more difficult to place because that's getting expensive. So we're pushing further and further out, which makes it, you know, more difficult for families to lose their connectivity and the likes.
Okay. I'm glad to hear that we're looking at a high level and a future level in terms of policies and all of these mechanisms that were set in place, but now limitable.
One thought we would sort of tinkered with is pooling funds by region. So when we get our pot of money, which is up now upwards of, I think, $3 million, Alameda has their millions of dollars in Contra Costa, you know, pooling it to a Bay Area region, which would be $15 million. Maybe we have three contractors serving that $15 million. There's a lot of sort of different thinking that's sort of beyond simply, it's our county's CalWORKS program and we're only serving our families here in San Francisco, which is really doesn't make sense in the context of providing housing work.
Thank you. I have a motion and a second. Favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Beatley.
Good morning, Commissioners.
Good morning.
My name is Andy Beatley. I'm a program monitor for the Fiscal Intermediary Services Contract. The Department of Human Services requests authorization to modify the existing contract agreement with Public Partnership LLC for the period of July 1st, 2016 to June 30th, 2021 for an additional amount of $1,300,000 plus a 10% contingency for a total amount not to exceed $3,854,263. The purpose of the modification is to extend the contract term for an additional 2 years for fiscal intermediary and reporting services that will support the individual referral program and the CalWORKS information and referral program. Through the IR, the individual referral program, employment and training services, the department partners with private vocational training schools who enroll and provide employment training and direct job placement with job retention services and wraparound case management services for eligible CalWORKS, PAYS, CalFresh, NAVA, and refugee cash assistance participants. Request for qualifications number 817, HSA is establishing a pool of agencies contracted to increase awareness of the CalWORKS program and to refer potentially eligible families to HSA. When requested by the Human Services Agency, PPL will issue payments to IR providers on behalf of program participants for the specialized vocational trainings and CalWORKS information and referral providers for referrals resulting in an approved application. Upon receiving invoices, designated DHS staff approves and forwards the payment request to PPL, which in turn makes the payments. PPL is based in Boston, but I'm available to answer any questions. Thank you.
Second. Moved and seconded. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. I would like to acknowledge the reappointment of Commissioner Rita Simmel. And we say thanks for hanging on. Thank you.